All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And hello, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. We're very excited to have you here this weekend to talk about a number of different things that occurred during the first week of August. This is kind of a program is This Week in History. And so we're going to be talking about a couple of events that occurred, one was 70 years ago, and another one was 51 years ago, and the other one was just 41 years ago, approximately. And that's, I was just reading a paper today and I forgot all about it. You know, people our age, and you know who I'm talking to out there, you know, that Richard Nixon resigned his presidency back in 1974. And it seemed like forever ago that happened. And the world kind of has changed dramatically since then. Politics has changed. Everything has changed. But that's the one thing, first thing that occurred. The second thing is, what we want to talk about today is we're going to be talking about the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August 4th in 1945. Also, I want to let people know that we have a little segment from a program. This is how long Veterans Radio has been on the air, folks. From August 7th, 2005, and our departed partner, Gary Lilly, and our other partner, Ken Rogge, are interviewing Captain or Major Van Kirk, who would happen to be the navigator on the Enola Gay. And this is really, it was really powerful when I found this interview from, 10 years ago. And, of course, we don't hear Gary that anymore, obviously, but we did, to hear him on the program, I think many of you will like that. As usual, he does a wonderful interview with Major Van Kirk and talking about what the crew from the Enola Gay thought about when they were dropping the bomb on Hiroshima, and whether, you can talk about whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. And we're going to talk about that during the program with my guest when we bring Dwight on the line. But we're going to be talking to our historian and good friend and award-winning writer, Dwight Zimmerman, is going to be on to kind of help me out, to keep me on track, because he's written stories and books and articles about both of these things that we wanted to talk about today, and that was the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and also the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which occurred back in 1964 on August 2nd when supposedly, and we're going to get into this supposedly, that the Navy ship, the USS Maddox, was attacked by North Vietnamese gunboats. And if anybody's out there got different information from what we give today, make sure you give us a call. The local number here in Ann Arbor is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Toll-free, the number is 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET, V-E-T, 1600. We want to have you and your input into these two really important issues. But first, I have a couple of announcements of events that are coming up. And again, if you have an event that you want us to talk about on the program, please, please, please let us know when the event is going to occur and what you need from us, because we would be more than happy to talk about that particular event on your whenever it's going to occur, so that we can do this for you. Coming up pretty soon, actually at the end of the month, it was that we have Thunder Over Michigan. Yay, this is always the best air show in the Midwest, we think, here locally. And Thunder Over Michigan is out at Willow Run, and it's going to be the weekend of August 29th and 30th. We are hoping to be out there on Sunday the 30th to talk to some of the pilots and so forth. You have to go out there and see these airplanes and helicopters and the new museum that they're building. Support the Yankee Air Museum. These people are doing an amazing job. They're going to be setting up schooling for aviators and technicians, and they're rebuilding their museum, and it's just going to be an amazing event. And that is out at the Willow Run Airport at the Yankee Air Museum. For more information, you can go to theyankeeairmuseum.org, and you can find out what it will cost for you to go if you want to go. There's 3-day passes. As I mentioned, there are airplanes, there's helicopters, there's static displays, there's reenactments, there's assaults of fake bombings, there are acrobatic pilots and all kinds of things. And I think you're just going to love it out there. It's always a great, great adventure, especially take your kids out there because they just, you know, they always find it very exciting. The Blue Angels are going to be there. That's the Navy acrobatic team. And you won't believe what these people can do at 600-800 miles an hour in these jets. It's just an amazing thing. So check that one out. I think you'll really enjoy it. For those of you that like to play golf, and that's, you know, somebody sent me an email the other day. My good friend Conrad out in Phoenix, Arizona, scored a hole in one. 69 years old, gets his first hole in one, so he has to brag about it. And he says, "Oh, so how's your golf game?" I said, "Well, it's just as dangerous as ever." I said, "Whenever I go out and play, people want to duck and hide, and you know, because the ball makes a loud noise when it hits the trees close to the tee, like when I hit them." But so anyway, congratulations to Conrad for hitting a hole in one. It's pretty cool. But there is a golf tournament coming up on Grosse Isle, and this is sponsored by the veteran-owned businesses of Southeastern Michigan, and they want you to come on out and play in their second annual golf outing. And this is on August 14th at the Grosse Isle Country Golf and Country Club on Bellevue Road in Grosse Isle Township, Michigan. And it begins at 11 o'clock, goes till 6, so you don't have to get up and play, you know, one of those early morning scramble-type tee-offs, it sounds like. But this is to raise money for the organization, which they will then share with all the different groups around veterans organizations and so forth. So this is veteran-owned businesses of Southeastern Michigan. You can find out more about them by going to theveteransroundtable.org. Veteranroundtable.org. It's a great opportunity coming up there. The other thing is that the state of Michigan, in their infinite wisdom, has decided to honor their Vietnam veterans. And on October 8th, there is going to be a celebration for all Vietnam veterans at the at the state capitol in Lansing. And that's October 8th. I believe it starts at noon. We will be there. Bob is in the negotiating process of what they need from us, and we will be up there. It's a Thursday, I believe. And so we encourage you to come on up to Lansing. There'll be more information as soon as we get more information out to you to let you start thinking about it. So all you Vietnam veterans in the state of Michigan, I don't care, Ohio, wherever you happen to be, come on down to Michigan, and we'll celebrate that you were able to survive the war in Vietnam. And it's nice that they're doing this. And so I'm anxious to go up there and see what they've got in mind. It should be an interesting day for us. So we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back with our guest, Dwight Zimmerman, and we're going to be talking about the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima in 1945. Hopefully we'll have time today to also talk about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So those are the two main events that we're going to be talking about. Again, if you would get in on the conversation, you can give us a call at 734-822-1600 or toll-free 844-838-1600. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
History, in every century, records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and as you could tell by the music, we're going to be talking about World War II. It seems so long ago, but it's always in the spotlight. We always want to be talking about the greatest generation. We want to always be talking about what happened as a result of World War II. And one of the most contagious or the most interesting things about that was the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And joining me on our program today is our good friend of Veterans Radio, and that is Dwight Zimmerman. And Dwight, welcome back.
Thank you, Dale. It's always great to be on the program. And you know, in this particular anniversary, it's also quite humbling because obviously with the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, that ushered in, you know, the atomic age with in all its awful glory and consequences.
Well, Dwight, you know, we talked earlier in the week, and I asked you to be on the program because you have written about this a little bit, and you've also written about the Gulf of Tonkin, which we'll get to later on in the program. So tell me about some of the stories that you have written about the dropping of the bomb.
Well, the biggest thing about this is that looking over the perspective of the time period of 1945, when Harry Truman was informed, this is the big thing. He was vice president in Franklin Roosevelt's administration, and he was completely aced out of the any information about the Manhattan Project.
Right, so he was clueless about the existence of this bomb.
Exactly. And so the day that he is inaugurated, following Franklin Roosevelt's death, Secretary of War Henry Stimson comes up to him and says, "Mr. President, I have to tell you about this powerful weapon that we have in development." And that's the first that Harry Truman is hearing about the atomic bomb. So, and on top of that, okay, so here is the man who ultimately pulls the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
But the scientists themselves, they don't really know what the true consequences are going to be, because up until Alamogordo, it's all theoretical, because you're talking about splitting the atom in a very dynamic way, and there were discussions among these highest level of scientists and physicists and theoreticians. They said, well, if we do this because we are splitting atoms, does that mean that we are going to actually ignite the atmosphere and incinerate the Earth? Like a chain reaction, and suddenly it goes out of control, and there obviously would be no way to stop it. No one knew.
Holy moly. That would be frightening. That's a decision. That'd be a hard decision to make, I guess. Well, I don't know if it's going to work, but if it does, we'll be able to do this. But if it doesn't, we just disintegrated the whole world.
Yeah, this is one of the many things that I was discovering, where you had these major debates among the people involved in the Manhattan Project, saying, this is the ultimate weapon, but is this also the ultimate weapon that destroys Earth?
Right.
That's
still the fear today.
Yes, but on a different level, because at least we know that, no, it won't ignite the atmosphere.
Right, but I mean, the proliferation of atomic weapons,
right,
among who knows how many. And in fact, we're even arguing about it today with Iran, and where that's going to go. But that's a whole other program. We're not going to get into that one.
Right. The key here is, just to get back on point, is that these individuals were weighing many things, ranging from the consequences, whether or not the thing would explode the way that they think it would, because, again, that hadn't, you're in a completely new type of bomb-making capability that no one had ever gone there before. And so there were so many theories clashing against each other. Then you had the secondary problem of, well, not secondary, but the linked problem of the war against Japan.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about earlier, and that I've been reading recently and researching for this, is the argument from both sides of whether we needed to do this or not to do this. And, what were the consequences of it going to be? Because meaning the United States, had already firebombed Dresden in Germany to get them to surrender. We'd already firebombed Tokyo to get them to surrender, and the Japanese did not surrender. And even when we were threatening, to drop this, they they still didn't surrender, although there are, you know, rumors of which we may get into later on about that there were secret negotiations going on and so forth.
Okay, well, the rumors are actually true. Now, there are a variety of factors here. One aspect was, and this is a very cogent argument, the U.S. Navy, the submarine force, had turned the Sea of Japan into a U.S. submarine, you know, a tactical exercise base. Mm-hmm. We literally had sealed off Japan. Not to get into the long discussion about that, but effectively, we had isolated Japan from all of its sources, you know, in Korea, Manchuria, because they were dependent on traffic, you know, for foodstuffs and minerals and everything. And it is to our U.S. Navy submarine force credit that they wound up creating this iron ring around the Japanese islands. So, on the one hand, we could have completely isolated Japan and forced it to surrender through starvation, but that would have taken time. So that would have basically meant 46, maybe 1947, that's speculation, but obviously the biggest impact would have been on the Japanese civilian population. We wanted to end the war quickly. Mm-hmm. And there were genuine feelers from certain sections of the Japanese government, and it's really important to understand it was certain sections, because the Japanese government was not united in wanting to secure peace. Even at this late date, the military faction, the militarists, the extreme hard right, were wanting to, essentially, they were completely nihilistic. We would term it that way. But they refused to accept defeat, and they were even going so far as to plan the execution of the emperor.
Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty serious stuff.
It is. And when the emperor actually recorded his surrender message, there was an attempt by these militarists to capture that recording, you know, and destroy it. So now, obviously, we didn't know all of those things going on, you know, internally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Truman is faced with a situation, you know, he is told by MacArthur that if we invade Japan, casualties will be upwards of a million troops.
Right. In fact, I've read an article called An Invasion Not Found in the History Books by a gentleman named James Martin Davis, who wrote in the Omaha World Herald about this and how there was a whole plan to, you know, invade Japan, and all of the stories that were going along with it of how many people they were going to need, how many people were being transferred from Europe to the Pacific, because since that war was over, there were rumors and probably true stories that they already had the Purple Hearts already minted.
When you mention that Purple Heart, I was going to say, yes, the Purple Hearts that are awarded, I don't know if the last of the World War II minted.
They're still giving them away.
Right.
Oh,
but it was, to their credit, they looked at the worst case scenario and made the contingencies, you know, go right down the line in all the different things, which you well know about the detail aspect. And so when Truman is told about the weapon, you know, and following Okinawa, and we've isolated Japan, and we've told them, you know, and this is Potsdam, prior to Potsdam, which is the meeting between the three major powers, Soviet Union under Stalin, Great Britain under Churchill, and then later Clement Attlee, because in the middle of that they had an election and Attlee succeeded Churchill, and then Harry Truman.
Well,
and when Alamogordo had its testing.
I got to jump in here for a second, Dwight. I don't mean to do that. But we do have a pre-recorded interview that we want to play for people. So we're going to hold off on our comments until we come back from this, because it's going to take about 14 minutes plus the news. So it's all in there. So we'll gather all of our thoughts. But this is an interview that we did on August 7th, 2005, with Gary Lilly and Ken Rogge, with the navigator of the Enola Gay. And he talks about, should we have dropped the bomb or shouldn't we have dropped the bomb? And he talks about how the crew responded to this and how he thought that this was the right thing to do. And so we're coming up on that in about 30 seconds. So remember, if you've got questions or comments that you'd like to get in on it, give us a call, 734-822-1600, toll-free 844-838-1600. So stay tuned. Listen to this interview. We're going to take the news at the bottom. We're going to come out with Medal of Honor. Then Gary will reintroduce his interview, and then we'll be back to take your questions at, in a little bit. So in the meantime, we're going to go to that right now. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
We would like to welcome Major Theodore J. Dutch Van Kirk to our show. Major Van Kirk was the navigator of the Enola Gay, and that was the first B-29 that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Major Van Kirk, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, sir.
I don't want to spend a lot of time going into the background, because there's so much to talk about with the atomic bomb, but I was shocked in talking to you earlier this week that you were flying bombing missions over Germany in B-17s prior to being transferred to the B-29s.
That is correct. I was on the second bombing mission out of England in 1942 and flew 58 missions over there total.
Now, we've always heard that 25 missions and you were on your way home, and that was the goal. How did you happen to do 58 missions, Major?
Well, I had 11 up in England, and then they moved us down to North Africa, and North Africa wasn't as tough as it was in England, so they changed it to 50 down there. And I had 58 before they instituted that policy.
And flying over in North Africa had its own set of problems, because you were flying over a lot of water to reach the bombing target. Weren't you at the end of the range of your bombers by the time you hit your targets over there?
Almost all the time, yep. There was no room for navigational area, I'd say that.
Who was your pilot during those early B-17 missions?
The same pilot I had on Hiroshima, Paul Tibbetts.
So you guys were together a long time. I assume you're still friends to this day?
That is absolutely correct. I just talked to him last week.
This is a special time of year for you. Yesterday was the 60th anniversary of dropping the bomb. As you look back on it, any regrets?
No regrets whatsoever. I think it was a necessary thing to do. It saved a lot of lives. It took a lot of lives, but it also saved a lot of lives. And there's no doubt in my mind that it saved a lot more lives than what it took.
Did the rest of the crew feel that way?
Absolutely, every one of us. There's a lot of rumors and everything about us, people on the crew going crazy, people on the crew going into monasteries and things of that type. That's all a bunch of baloney. Nobody on the crew ever went crazy. Nobody ever went into the monastery. We all had very good lives after the war.
Major, this is Ken Rogge. How many crew members did you have on the 29?
Well, we had 9 regular crew members, and we had 3 extras, 2 guys to take care of the bomb, and a third man to deliver radar countermeasures as we were approaching Japan.
And how many of those 9 regular crew members were on the 17s with you?
3 of us.
3 of you.
Oh. Paul Tibbetts, myself, and Tom Ferriby were all on the B-17.
Major, going back to the dropping of the bomb and what you were commenting on, I think there was a movie that depicted the dropping of the bomb that was made sometime in the early 50s, and which the co-pilot, or was it Paul Tibbetts, said, "My God, what have we done?"
Well, I remember it somewhat differently and somewhat more profanely, but I won't mention what it was.
Okay. The account that I read said that the navigator, or not the navigator, the co-pilot wrote in his log, "My God," with two exclamation points, and Hollywood picked up on that.
I think that was written sometime after we got back to Tinian, and was written primarily for the press because it sounded a lot better than what he actually said.
Oh, okay. A lot of those quotes were changed for the purpose of the press.
Absolutely.
Now, in 1947, Paul Tibbetts was at an event in which the Japanese pilot that led the attack on Pearl Harbor also attended, and they met and spoke to each other. Do you recall that meeting?
I've talked to Paul about that several times, yes, sir.
Tell me what was said, please.
Well, I think Paul made a comment to him. Well, at first they didn't know, they'd recognize and did not know each other. And the Japanese fellow, Kishida, said to Paul, shall we talk about it? And Paul says, what talk about what? And he says, well, by land, I was the guy that led the attack on Pearl Harbor. So they talked about their individual roles, the Pearl Harbor role versus the Hiroshima role, and both agreed that they were doing it was a military objective and everything of that type. And they just had a nice conversation. That's all there was to it.
Okay, we'll get back to that right after this break. Major, will you stay with us?
I certainly will.
Thank you.
You're listening to Veterans Radio. The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Commander Eugene Flueckey, with four Navy Crosses and the Medal of Honor, is one of the most highly decorated servicemen in American history. Details after this.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Flueckey submarine moving along the China coast located a convoy of more than 30 Japanese ships anchored in a harbor. The harbor was shallow and heavily mined with threatening rock formations. If he got close enough to attack, it would require a run at full speed under very dangerous conditions. Flueckey ordered the attack anyway. In water only 30 feet deep, he maneuvered to within range and launched four torpedoes from the forward tubes and four from the rear tubes. He watched eight direct hits, turned his sub around, and headed for open sea. He was awarded the Medal of Honor by Navy Secretary James Forrestal on March 23, 1945. 4 months later, Flueckey, after sinking an enemy frigate, landed a shore party on the Japanese coast which set an explosive device on railroad track that destroyed a military train. This was the only combat operation on the Japanese mainland during the war. Flueckey retired in 1972 as a rear admiral. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And you're listening to an interview that was done by Gary Lilly and Ken Rogge with Theodore Dutch Van Kirk, the navigator on the Enola Gay, back in August of 2005. So I just wanted to reintroduce that to you. Also wanted to remind everybody that we here at Veterans Radio, we want to take a second and just say how much that we miss Gary. Gary Lilly was killed, unfortunately, on August 4th of 2011. It's been 4 years since Gary passed away. And I just wanted to let people know that we are thinking about Gary every single day. So we're going to go back to the interview that Gary and Ken had with Dutch Van Kirk. And again, this was recorded right here at WHAM, August 7th, 2005.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with Major Theodore Van Kirk, who was the navigator on the Enola Gay. Picking up on that last question, Major Van Kirk, when Paul Tibbetts spoke to the leader of the raid on Pearl Harbor, my understanding is that he said, the Japanese pilot said that we did the right thing when we dropped the atomic bomb. Do you recall that?
I do recall that, and we get that quite a lot from the Japanese. I just earlier this year, we met a Japanese fellow who was trained to be a kamikaze pilot, and he thanked us profusely for dropping the bomb so that he didn't have to go out on a kamikaze mission. And if I might just take a minute here, I'd like to address some of the comments of your previous interviewee.
Please.
Because I agree with what his objectives wholeheartedly. But in Hiroshima, they always make it sound as if we were simply going up there and bombing civilians, and that was not the case. There were over 100 numbered military targets within the city of Hiroshima. And those military targets, especially the one of them, which was in the headquarters of the Japanese Army, charged with their defense in the event of invasion. That target there and the other military targets, with all the materials being sent to Shikoku for the defense of Japan, they were all military targets, and we wanted to knock them out. Yes, there were a lot of civilians killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but a good portion of the people killed there were military men and women who were there in that particular service. In addition to which, there were about 50,000 Korean conscripted laborers in Hiroshima. Yes, they were civilians, but they were conscripted and forced to be there by the Japanese. And a large number of the people killed, roughly about 25,000 or so, were those people. Second point, the largest air raid of the war in terms of a number of B-29s up over Japan in that raid was flown after Nagasaki. The number of targets killed, number of people killed, the amount of damage done by those 1,000 B-29s has never been talked about, never explained or anything else. And I simply can't understand your previous interviewees, this distinction between the firebombs and the atomic bomb. If you're dead, you're dead, period. And it only did to your, he's right, it only did take one plane, whereas it took more planes for the firebombs and that raid after the war. But the Japanese leaders were warned. We dropped hundreds of thousands of leaflets over Japan before we ever dropped the atomic bomb, telling them what was going to happen. We dropped another hundreds of thousands of leaflets between Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Japanese leaders said Truman's request for surrender was not even worth considering. If anybody bears any responsibility for the Japanese deaths at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it was the Japanese leaders of that time. And I think I've already said enough on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you did, because you cleared up a lot of information and you educated me a little bit on, well, you educated me a lot on that. So, immediately afterwards, what took place?
Immediately after dropping the bomb, after the bomb dropped, we saw a bright flash in the airplane, and then we took two shock waves. The scientists told us early on, we think the airplane will be okay if you're 8 miles away when the bomb explodes. The only trouble was we couldn't figure out how to get 8 miles away. So we had to strip down the airplane, took all the guns out of the airplane, all the turrets out of the airplane, all the weight out of the airplane we could get, and then we'd get up higher and go faster, and that's how we got away from the bomb. But we still took two pretty sharp shock waves, and they were measured at about 2.5 to 3 G's, a B-29 at 30,000 feet. So that was a pretty good jolt. And after we got the jolts, we turned on to take a look at what had happened, and we could make absolutely no visual observation on what had happened in Hiroshima, because the bomb had kicked up a lot of smoke, dust, debris, and everything of that type, and we couldn't see anything down there. So we just merely turned around and went back to our base.
Of course, there was a huge mushroom cloud.
Huge mushroom cloud had formed. It was already up to 42,000-45,000 feet.
How far away could you still see it?
We could see it from, well, we started letting down, but we were about 15,000 feet, as I recall, and we could see it 162 miles away.
Wow.
Well, I can understand the words, my God. That was, did you expect it?
Yes. They did. They fully briefed us on what had happened at the test site in New Mexico. They told us everything that they expected to happen. That they told us what we could expect to happen. But they always used a little few weasel words in there just in case it didn't happen the way they said it.
Okay. Well, I can't believe how fast the time has gone, and I understand you want to say something about the Yankee Air Museum here in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Well, I really appreciate those guys. I was up there to their air show several years ago. It was a great show. They do a great service to the country. I heard your talk about the number of B-17s who are flying around over your house or somebody's house and everything of that type. And all I can say, it must have made an awful racket. We went by.
8 of the 9 B-17s still flying in North America were in Ypsilanti today at Willow Run Airport.
Is that right? Well, I last flew on one in February when Paul Tibbetts had his 90th birthday down here in Atlanta. And we had 400 people invited and 900 people showed up.
Oh, my.
Some of them did get barbecue. That's all I'll say.
They
had a B-17 there, and I got a chance to fly it.
The B-17s were awesome out there. The whole air show was just fantastic.
I'm sure it was.
There was also a B-24 and B-25s. And
the only two surviving flyable B-24s were there.
Well, there's one B-29 that's still flying. Well, it's not still flying. It's laid up for maintenance right now.
Right.
But we're working on getting another one operating again, and it's right now it's sitting out at Wichita, Kansas. We need about $2 million to get the engines all repaired and everything else. And a fellow named Tony Mazzolini in Cleveland, Ohio, is the guy ramrodding the whole thing. If anyone has $2 million, Tony, we sure welcome him.
I can't quite cover that myself.
I might have to cash a paycheck. I don't know.
Major, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. I would love to have you back.
I would love to be there anytime. Give me a call.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye now.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio. That was Gary Lilly talking with Theodore Dutch Van Kirk, the navigator on the Enola Gay, who dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Unfortunately, Major Van Kirk cannot be back on the radio program except through the magic of our technology. He passed away last July. So anyway, we are talking with Dwight Zimmerman. Dwight, I hope you got to listen to that whole thing.
It was, it was really impressive. I was making a couple of additional notes. His comments about the subsequent reactions of individuals was very cogent. And it gets back to the statements that I made at the beginning of the program. One thing that he touched on very briefly and was very controversial was the stripping of the guns from the B-29s. And on top of that, both in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, only one B-29 flew over the target area.
I was going to say, did they have armed escorts or did fighter planes follow them along? And they just kind of went by themselves.
They went by themselves. They flew at a higher altitude because they calculated the uppermost flight of any Japanese fighter craft.
Mm-hmm.
But needless to say, the crews were not exactly happy to know that they didn't have any machine guns that could defend them. But it was one of those situations where, and this was what Paul Tibbetts did, he stripped the B-29s that were going to drop the bomb of as much weight as possible to gain as much altitude as possible.
Right, get the heck out of there. Right, get out
right.
of Dodge.
And, so this was a, contributing factor in this because in addition to dropping the bomb, the United States military was making a statement of, we can send one plane unprotected over a target site and drop a bomb, and there's nothing you can do to stop us.
Yeah, that's kind of fascinating to me, Dwight, when we talk about, that we were dropping the bomb, and as Van Kirk was saying, they dropped these, hundreds of thousands of leaflets, get out of the way, we're going to do this, this is happening, this is going to happen now, oh, it just happened, oh, by the way, it's going to happen again, and they still, did not surrender until we dropped the second one. Little did they know that we didn't have any more.
Well, yeah, certainly we're not going to advertise that fact.
No, I realize that, but the point is, saying the end.
Well, here was a consequence. In one aspect, the atomic bomb was too good of a weapon, because when it dropped on Hiroshima, it wiped out communications and the people who had access to the government in Tokyo.
So Tokyo
there was
really didn't know
a
what happened.
Serious down period between what happened and what got conveyed to Tokyo, and that actually led to, it was a part and parcel of why Nagasaki was attacked.
So there was this built-in delay.
Right.
That was a consequence of dropping the bomb on there. Let's talk a little bit. For our listeners out there from the Vietnam era that were hoping to listen to us talk about the Gulf of Tonkin, I don't think we're going to be able to get to that today. So mark your calendars. I'll let you know when we are going to do that program, because I want to get into talking about the preparations that not only we had here in the United States, but also what Japan had if we had to invade the mainland. Can we talk a little bit about that now?
Oh, Lord.
It was frightening to me. It was very
disturbing. Basically, you had two separate factions. One, the realistic one, that said, Japan is going to lose. Let's sue for peace. And so they're putting out the feelers through, Switzerland, Sweden, any way they could. And, yes, we were hearing them, but we were also sending back, that's all well and fine. I'm obviously paraphrasing, but you're saying you have to step forward publicly and state this. You can't do this, under the table. Then you have the military side of it, the really hardcore ones who, because of their society, because of, their psychology and everything, they really were looking at scorched earth. Just as Hitler publicly stated it with Nazism, and we saw that, in the various programs that he had, as the Allies are marching through Germany, Japan was in the same boat. The big difference was that in Europe, we were going across land, whereas in Japan, it was an island, and we would have to make an amphibious attack. And we had had enough experience with all the different campaigns across the Pacific, culminating with Iwo Jima and Okinawa. So we're looking at this and saying, to actually invade the home islands, then it's like times 10, or do your geometric.
What are the algorithms for that one?
Exactly.
This article that I found that I mentioned earlier that people can find on the internet is An Invasion Not Found in the History Books. It talks about that. It says deep in the recesses of the National Archives of Washington, I think this is the one that I sent you, hidden for nearly four decades are thousands of yellowing and dusty documents stamped top secret, which is plans for Operation Downfall, which was going to be the invasion of Japan. And they were planning on two invasions if they hadn't dropped the bombs and the bombs hadn't worked. The first was going to be Operation Olympic, where American combat troops would land in Japan on November 1st, 1945. 14 divisions of soldiers and Marines, and after an unprecedented naval and aerial bombardment, they were hoping that they would surrender. If they didn't, then they were going to go back on March 1st, 1946, with Operation Coronet that would send at least 22 more divisions against 1 million Japanese defenders. Every Marine in the world was going to be involved in that one, along with pretty much every military ship, soldier, airman, whatever it was going to go in that. And they just figured that the casualties were just going to be outrageous. Well over a quarter of a million Americans and untold numbers of Japanese were going to be killed.
Exactly. The They were already, you know, once victory in Europe was done, they were starting to transport the troops from Europe, transiting them, you know, across the United States, you know, to the West Coast, you know, getting them ready for action, you know, in Japan. And you raised a very good point. They didn't know that the atomic bomb would still work.
Right.
Even though the tests had been done in New Mexico, we only had two functional bombs. And one of them, or both of them, could have still been duds.
Right. Yes. And if this hadn't worked, they would have kept fighting it. It's saying here in the article that Japanese broadcasts of Japan were closed all schools, mobilizing its school children, arming its civilian population.
Yes. It was just amazing what, even at this late date, they were looking at a war of annihilation. And that was so frightening, you know, the consequences of that, because, you know, we had two completely different societies, you know, and so the criticism that has subsequently been levied against Harry Truman for making the decision that he did as president to drop the bombs is really wrong-headed, because it's applying today's values
right
on what happened then.
That's a very important point. In fact, there's a letter today in the New York Times that said dropping the bombs was a 1945 decision, not a 2015 one. And so it's very hard for us to transport back in time and think about the devastation to the world that had occurred over that 15-year time period with Japan and Germany and Italy and, you know, the rest trying to take over the world and destroying the world in the process. And so you're right. Harry Truman had to make this decision. And
he agonized over it.
Oh, I can't imagine. Yeah. But as I read these things that he's talking about, you know, how many kamikaze pilots were still in training. You mentioned, you know, Van Kirk mentioned when it was so grateful that they had dropped the bomb.
Yep.
But they were planning to sink everything that they could. I mean, the example, of course, is Okinawa, where they sank 32 Allied ships and damaged more than 400 others. In fact, my father's ship was one of the ones that was damaged. So I can only imagine what they were going to try and do if we were actually invading their homeland.
Oh, yeah. It was just everything that I had read in my research was that you know, the military leadership had, quite frankly, gone insane. I'm using mm-hmm. that term because they were just so how else can you explain the fact that you would willingly wipe out your nation's population, civilian and military? It's one thing to command your troops in what amounts to a suicide charge.
Right.
Yeah. It's another thing to throw civilians and everything. A lost cause is a lost cause. And for as bitter as it is, and we had that with Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
In the Confederacy, you know, during our, you know, Civil War, and varying other, wars are ugly. Wars are not nice. I'm a civilian, as you well know, and as, the listeners know. That said, it is the conflicts that, you know, have occurred over, you know, history. It is just such an amazing thing to see how individuals, nations react, some noble, some, you know, and then the losers, especially, how they accept losing. And Japan and Nazi Germany were the worst in the respect of their obligations to their civilian population, that they did not accept losing, that they said that the best alternative was to destroy everything.
I don't even know what the population was of Japan, but I'm reading these things, and you know, again, intelligence. You know, you never realize how important intelligence is during a war until it's over. It seems like, or the mistakes are made, and you know, oh well, we didn't know. And you can look at, you know, you can look at 9/11. You can look at ISIS, and you know, intelligence and all these other things.
There are all kinds of mistakes.
We're looking here. You know, and they said, you know, we thought that the Japanese had about 2,500 airplanes left, and according to this article, it said they had almost 6,000 of them left. 12,000 planes of all types. Every village had some type of aircraft manufacturing activity hidden in mines, railway tunnels, under viaducts, and in basements of department stores. Work was being done to construct new planes. So they were not going to go down without a fight, just as you mentioned. You know, whether it was scorched earth or you know, kamikaze or samurai or whatever it was. So I think that, as you pointed out early on, they really didn't give Harry Truman a choice. I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, the options were, well, we can, you know, we can starve them out. But
at what cost to the civilian population? Because they would be the ones who would, you know, be hurt the most.
Right. You know, and it said, you know, well, they could blockade Japan. Well, we'd already blockaded Japan. They weren't getting anything that was coming in.
Right.
Everything, as we know, in a militaristic society like that, everything's going to be, the first people to get fed are going to be the military, as you just pointed out. And, you know, until that, I mean, I know we're not solving any problems here, and, you know, this is never going to probably, the debate will never end. But thankfully, we've never had to have this debate again.
Yes, well, the most important point here in commemorating the dropping of the atomic bombs, which thankfully quickly ended World War II, is that it pointed out that sometimes it takes a very extreme act, which this was, to end a very terrible conflict. People died. A lot of innocent people died. That is the ultimate tragedy of this, but you can't pinpoint that to simply the dropping of the atomic bomb, because you know the whole war, you know, so many civilians suffered tragically. Here, the best legacy for me is that it has never happened again.
Absolutely, Dwight. On that note, I want to read a quick letter to the editor today, and it sounds like I wrote it, but I didn't. It says, I am here, no doubt, because the bomb was dropped. My father was on a ship filled with young Americans steaming to Japan for the final invasion. It was predicted to be a brutal campaign. When the bombs were dropped and Japan surrendered, the news came to the ship, and my father told me a cheer spread from one end of the ship to the other, as thousands of young American boys knew that battle would not need to be fought. And
yes,
thankfully for that, I'm here, and many of my friends are here, and so many of the baby boomers are here, because without that, we would have never survived. So, Dwight,
yes,
thank you again, as usual, for being on Veterans Radio, and I'll get back to you when we want to talk about the Gulf of Tonkin, all righty?
Yes, indeed, and thank you, Dale, and everyone out there.
Thanks again. All right, so we brought you some information I don't think you'd ever had before. And just to remind those of you who are just tuning in right now, we had a segment in the middle of an interview that Gary Lilly did back in 2005. So you're going to have to wait till we upload the program to our archives, and then you can listen to the whole show. So we want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio this week. Next week, Bob Gould will be your host, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. And until then, you are dismissed.